All right, well, I assume that among the people who are either missing or will come in late are people who are still grappling with their papers. So the initial thing I wanted to say, which is about how to deal with late papers, will go on deaf ears, so to speak, here. Or non-ears, not deaf ears. Anyone who, I'll send an email around, I suppose, to clarify this. Anyone who can't hand in their paper today, the third paper, what I will want is a email giving me a specific date by which the paper will be in, so it's a kind of contract. And then if that date is after the time I turn in grades, you'll get an incomplete, which I'll then change after the paper comes in. I will feel absolved of responsibility for writing comments, as I said, on papers that aren't handed in today. Sometimes I still write some comments. You know, this is it's an odd thing. I find it extremely hard to read a paper without writing comments. You know, partially because writing comments on papers is what makes it interesting, sometimes more interesting for me. It means that I'm actively engaged in whatever the ideas are, trying to figure things out. But still, my sense of obligation around commenting is sort of a binary. It's either full bore or I'm absolved of it. So that's the main penalty. I have, as a general practice, except under certain circumstances, of not penalizing people on grades for late papers. That's simply out of a practical recognition of the complexity of people's lives, and that mostly when papers are handed in late, there's something about a person's life and obligations and pressures that explains it, as opposed to them just being a slacker and not caring. And since I have no capacity to distinguish the two cases systematically, I take the stance that every late paper is due to a good reason. Right, so that's my general stance towards that. And therefore, any punitive action in terms of grades, since grades do matter, for better or worse, it's part of the system by which people get into graduate schools and get fellowships. I mean, all the things that do matter. Grades are one of the things that matters. I just don't feel it's appropriate, or at least for me, I don't feel it's appropriate to dock a grade for being late. But I do feel it, given that it's a greater burden on me to write comments once I'm done with the task, you know, and on to other things, to have papers coming in late. That's an extra burden on me, then that seems the appropriate kind of quid pro quo aspect of the late paper issue, right? So that's how we'll proceed on that. Now, for today's agenda, as I said last time, ending the semester on micro foundations of ideology didn't seem the kind of, you know, punchy rah-rah, you know, end of this class. So what I think I'm going to do is, in the first part of the class until the break, we'll work on micro foundations. I'll make a few comments just to end up concluding comments about the previous topic. Let me pass around. Here's the micro foundations outline. So I'll talk about this whole general problem of micro foundations and how to think about it. Then we'll take a break, and then I will share with you what I'm going to talk about in Athens on this topic that I haven't ever given a talk on before. So you'll see. I was going to bring, you know, do a PowerPoint, but then it seemed I just printed out the PowerPoints, so you'll have it for your notes. It might have been useful for me to show you the way I'm doing the PowerPoints, because it involves overlaying some graphs on top of each other in order to make a point, but you'll sort of get the point anyway from looking at it in the handout. So that's what we'll do after the break. All right, so first, just some little wrap-up. There was one small topic left over at the end of the last lecture on legitimation and hegemony, which is built on the outline as coercion, consent, and norms within capitalist production. One of the contexts in which the question of legitimation, I think, is relevant is not just the kind of system legitimacy. That's what we've mostly focused on. You know, ideologies about what is good that help support capitalism as a whole. So that certainly is one context where the what is good aspect of ideology is relevant. But I think it's also useful to think of these moral and normative aspects of ideology as bearing on micro settings of social life, not just the kind of big macro judgments about systems as a whole. And a very interesting setting to look at that is the workplace, the labor process. Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis. Sam Bowles is a Marxist economist, a very interesting scholar. Almost everything he's written I find interesting. He's one of these guys, he just, whatever he touches turns into interest. He has in the last 15 years been working in a whole different kind of area of economics, what's called evolutionary economics, and he's particularly interested in the question of the evolution of altruism, both in biology, so he's actually done some modeling of biological systems, but also the kind of evolutionary game theory of cooperative behavior in social life. He has a new book, very good book, I think, called The Evolution of Cooperation, which, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, it's definitely worth reading. He is the director of the economics program at the Santa Fe Institute, as well as a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I guess he's emeritus now at Amherst. The Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico is this extremely high-powered mathematical complex systems research institute, which is mostly physicists and mathematicians, some biologists, and then a few economists. So it's a kind of strange set of people. Well, let me tell you, I engaged in a debate with Sam. Michael Burvoy and I wrote a paper that was partially a critique, but mostly an engagement with a paper that they wrote. And I think the debate we had illustrates a way in which these normative questions, answers to the question, what is good, you know, these normative evaluations, can figure in the interior of analyses of things like exploitation. So let me just give you the very brief account of their argument and then how we responded to it, just as an illustration of this sort of thing. So they were writing a paper. The title of their paper is called Contested Exchange. It's definitely worth reading. It's easily available. If you Google Contested Exchange, you'll probably get the paper. They're addressing a standard economics problem as to why in a market economy you have in equilibrium unemployment. Because it should be the case in standard economics that if you have unemployment, then unemployed workers will bid down wages until the market clears. There should be no unemployed except voluntary unemployment. You know, people can withdraw from the labor market, but there shouldn't be any real unemployment. So they are addressing this question. The core of their argument is to make the following claim, that employers have strong incentives to pay their workers significantly above the market clearing wage. Right? So the market clearing wage is the lowest possible wage you can pay somebody to get them to work. You know, you think if you offer them anything less, they won't take the job. So the market clearing wage is the lowest possible wage you can pay. In practice, employers pay well above that. The difference between the market clearing wage and what employers pay workers is called an employment rent. It's a rent because there are workers out there who would accept the job for less than you're offering, and yet you don't offer them. So there's something about the employment relation which creates this gap. Now, here's their basic argument. The big problem employers face when they hire labor, this is a classic Marxian problem, is how do you get them to show up at work, but how do you get them to actually work? How do you get them to expend effort? So we can define a level of effort that workers will spontaneously perform in the workplace without any threats and no supervision. Let's call that the whistle while you work level of effort. The metaphor comes from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, when the Seven Dwarfs, they're miners, and they whistle while they work. That's their kind of joyful embrace of hard manual labor. So you have the whistle while you work level of effort. Well, that's below the level of effort that employers want their employees to work in most situations. So employers have to do something to get workers to work harder than workers would spontaneously work if there were no constraints on them. One way you do that is by threatening to fire them. But the threat to fire a worker who is paid the market clearing wage isn't that effective, because they don't care that much whether they lose their job. The difference between what they're earning on the job and what their reservation wage is, that is what their next best offer, isn't that big. If they are hired at a wage which, if it was a little bit lower, they wouldn't have taken the job. So by definition, the market clearing wage is just a little bit above the level at which a worker wouldn't have even wanted the job, which means they don't care that much if they get fired. So in order for the threat to be fired to really create fear on the part of the worker so that they will worry about it and therefore work harder, you have to pay them above the market clearing wage. And then you get a little formula, which is the more above the market clearing wage you pay the worker, that is, the higher you increase the cost of job loss, the less supervision, less money you have to spend on supervision. So let's just imagine the following. Here's just a simple example. You have an assembly line, old-fashioned, nasty factory where people do incredibly boring work. But you pay them $200,000 a year and then tell them, once a year, randomly, somebody's going to come around and see if you're working your butt off, and if you're not, you're fired on the spot. Okay, now, in this fantasy factory, people would probably work really hard because even though it's a low probability event, the consequence of getting caught shirking is huge given how much you're paid, you know, given that it's so enormously above. So that would be a case where the employer could spend virtually nothing on surveillance. They wouldn't have to hire an army of foremen. They could pay virtually nothing for surveillance, but they'd be paying a huge employment rent. So basically, then, you've got a little formula. The lower the employment rent, the more you have to spend on surveillance, because you have to increase the probability of getting caught, because the expected cost of job loss is a function, it's basically a multiplicative function of the probability of getting caught and the cost of losing your job. So if you make a very high probability of getting caught, you can have smaller employment rents, but then you have to spend more money on supervision. If you have a very big cost of losing your job, you can spend less on supervision. This will also vary by the technology of the job, because some jobs are easy to monitor and others are really hard to monitor. And in particular, it's very hard to monitor jobs in which it's not just the outward effort that matters, but the inner effort, right? So how much creativity, problem solving, complex deployment of skills, all these things, it just takes a lot of effort to really know whether a person is doing their best. So again, the more complex the labor process, the more skill and knowledge it involves, the less observable is effort, the bigger the employment rent, because that's the way you create a cost of job loss in those cases. Right, so that was the guts of their paper. Now, in their paper was based entirely on this kind of rational actor model, which I don't object to as a model for guiding research. But then the question was whether in actual workplaces this adequately describes why workers work as hard as they do. So the paper is an answer to the question, why do workers work so hard? And Michael Borovoy and I felt that it was a fine paper in terms of elaborating one particular mechanism in play, but it was unsatisfactory in actually answering the empirical question, why do workers work so hard? Because there's also an important normative aspect of the labor process. There are a variety of norms which come into play, norms and moral codes about the behavior of workers, which they believe in, and norms and codes about the behavior of managers, which workers believe in. And our paper then laid out this kind of normative or moral space, the moral economy of the labor process, as an additional set of arguments. So this isn't instead of their employment rents and surveillance model, but it's saying that's not adequate, and it'll be quite misleading in some contexts to see that that's the central mechanism going on. And I've listed in the outline the specific issues, the specific kinds of norms that do come into play. The one that I think is probably the most interesting is this idea of a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Right, so that's a classic working class principle of the moral economy of capitalist labor processes. Workers feel that if they're treated fairly by their employer, given a fair day's pay, then they have an obligation to give in return a fair day's work. And that they're really being a scoundrel if they shirk under conditions of being given a fair day's pay. Now, of course, that implies that there's a notion of what's a fair day's pay. That's not transparent. That may be contested. It changes over time. But nevertheless, it provides for a moral code that guides the work within the labor process, and not just a fear of sanctions from the employer. Well, I could go into more detail about the argument. I think that's enough for the present purposes. Now, the reason for bringing this up again is that the legitimation aspect of ideology, this moral core of whether practices and social relations institutions are desirable, figures in the micro settings of class interactions and not just the big political questions of the desirability of the system as a whole. All right, I'm going to, since we're starting the next